This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Biographies and Memoirs. Learn the life stories of your favorite contemporary and historical figures and the struggles and victories that made them who they are. World leaders, scientific innovators, creative minds, and celebrities inspire our own lives with their stories. It's Biographies and Memoirs, now on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Biographies and Memoirs, and I'm your reader, Margaret Ankenbrook, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I will be reading from the book Sonny Boy by Al Pacino, copyright 2024. And now I'll continue reading in Chapter 2, A Change. After class, Charlie and I would go out together. We became faithful drinking partners. His wife, Penny Allen, was an actor too, and they lived together in an apartment in the East 20s. They never had any money either. One time, Charlie came to the office at Commentary Magazine and asked me for $5, and I gave it to him. Later on, I lost the commentary job, and I was a man without work. My mother had moved up to 233rd Street to live with her parents, and I had our old apartment to myself. All I was facing was $38 a month in rent, but I was broke. I had profited all that I could from cashing in the beer bottles I had cluttering up my apartment, and now I had nothing. So I made my way out to find Charlie, who was in Far Rockaway. It was the summertime, and getting there from Manhattan was a journey. I took a bus to a train to another train, switched trains at another station until I reached the end of the line. It could take hours, and all the while I would read Balzac, Baudelaire, and Flaubert from pocket-sized books with the tiniest type you've ever seen. It was a hot day, and when I got to Far Rockaway, Charlie and Penny were on a beach with their baby girl, Deidre. I saw them by the surf, and I was walking on the sand, dressed all in black, shoes, pants, shirt, leather jacket, doing my paladin thing. They were all smiles as Charlie gave me a fiver, and I said, "Great, love you guys." Then I got on the train and began my long and complicated return voyage to Manhattan, reading my little books all the way back. Charlie and I worked together as moving men. We moved office furniture and lots of books. You should try it sometime. Just physically moving things from building to building, floor to floor. Not your own stuff, but doing it every day for someone else in walk-up buildings with no elevators there to get you up a few flights. Moving books, 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 and more books. Boxes of them. Our friend Matt Clark, who was in Charlie's acting class, ran our moving operation. He had started off small with a little truck moving pieces of art down in the village, then went on to moving apartments and got himself a bigger truck to handle bigger offices. He was good at this, as well as being an actor. How does an actor prepare? He carries a refrigerator up the stairs. Matt Clark looked at me like I was some guy from the Bronx, but he let me tag along and scrape together a few bucks, mainly because Charlie would vouch for me. I got on Matt's bad side when I dropped my end of a refrigerator going up a five-floor walk-up. Another time, we were moving an office, and as usual, I wandered off. I ended up in some sort of Christmas party on that floor. I was having a little food, sipping a scotch, and flirting with a couple of girls. Our job had stopped for a bit, and I figured I was due for a break. When Matt found out, it really took him over the edge, and I got fired right there on the spot. I explained it all to Charlie, and somehow he talked Matt into taking me back again. When I was growing up, we never had a telephone in the apartment, but now I finally had one. I got a call there from my father, who I had not heard from in months. His second marriage had gone bust, just like the first, and he had moved out to Los Angeles, where he was once again indulging in life as a single man, and he wanted me to join him. His invitation to me was to say in this phone call, "Why don't you come out here and take some of these girls off my hands?" Can you imagine that? The poor man wanted to connect with his son, and he finally felt he had something to offer me. He probably thought, "Hey, he's a regular kid. He's 19. He wants girls, doesn't he?" He didn't know enough to understand that his son was some kind of aspiring poet, artist, and Chekhov wannabe. I didn't care about girls. I mean, I did, but I didn't understand them or realize they were interested in me. It's taken me a lifetime to figure out that my father was just trying to reach me in a way he thought best. But at the time, it just made me feel like he didn't know me. So how could he? While I lived alone, I had to make rent. I tried it as a busboy and didn't make it. They caught me eating off the leftovers from the tables. That's how hungry I was. In my free time, I was a wanderer. I would walk the streets all day, and then I'd sit at the library pretty much for warmth. But I became a voracious reader. I had no teachers and no homework assignments, so I followed my own passions. Charlie Lawton helped suggest various writers to check out, things to read, places to go, like the 42nd Street Library for warmth and the Automat for sustenance. At the Automat, I could make a single cup of coffee last all morning and sit there for 5 hours while I read my little books of the great authors. There was something so absorbing about that gift of reading. It could calm your mind and give you another world to be engaged in. Television was too distant. Books were more intimate, like having friends and enjoying their company. I would be reading A Movable Feast and thinking, I don't want to finish the pages. I like it here too much. If the hour was late and you heard the sound of someone in your alleyway with a bombastic voice shouting iambic pentameter into the night, that was probably me, training myself on the great Shakespeare soliloquies. I would walk the streets of Manhattan bellowing out monologues as I rambled. I'd do it by the factories at the edges of town where no one was around. Where else was I going to go? Where could I emote? That's what you do when you're obsessed. In these side streets and passageways, I didn't need anyone's permission if I wanted to play Prospero, Falstaff, Shylock, or Macbeth. I grew to love one of Hamlet's monologues so much that I started to use it at auditions. I would say to the director, I know you have your pages that you want me to perform, but I have a little something that I've already prepared, if you don't mind. Usually they would give me back a look that told me they were already finished with me. Then I would hit them with this, oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion? That would occasionally give me a nod from someone as if to say, oh yes, very nice, see you in the next world. And out the door I went. Did I learn anything? I doubt it, but it felt good. Hamlet says something that pretty much summed up my own feelings about being taught how to act. Let your own discretion be your tutor. Suit the action to the word to the action, with this special observance that you're o'erstep not the modesty of nature, the censure of the which one must in your allowance, or weigh a whole theater of others. In other words, go to acting class, have an audience, show yourself that you can do the part, but don't listen to the teachers. You have to be careful. Take what they say and use only what you identify with. Just use it. There are no rules because when it comes right down to your performance, it doesn't matter what most people think. Your intuition should not be swayed by the audience, but by your own imagination and your willingness to go into yourself and express what's there. When I was about 19 or 20, Charlie and I had finished one of our wanderings full of walking and talking, and we came back to my Bronx apartment. As I looked in my mailbox, he was going up the stairs. He stopped on the stairway, looked back at me, paused, and then said, Al, you're going to be a big star. And Charlie never talked like that. I mean, never. As long as I knew him, he never said a word about that stuff. That was not his deal at all. It came out of nowhere. I said to him, I know, Charles, I know, and I meant it. Now, I'm not religious or anything, but I feel there's a spirit. You don't even have to call it God. In AA, they call it the higher power. Whatever it is, whatever you think it may be, that was mine. I believed it would happen, although it wasn't something I was preoccupied with at the time or really thought about at all. I just sort of assumed that was what was going to happen, and I accepted it. Whatever this acting thing was, I could do it. Another young actor in Charlie's class with me was a guy by the name of Martin Sheen. In one session, Marty did a monologue from The Iceman Cometh, and he blew the roof off. I said, "This is it. This is a great actor we're witnessing. This was the next James Dean, as far as I was concerned." I got to be friends with Marty Sheen, and one day he said to me, "You know what my real name is, don't you? Estevez." He was half Spanish and came from Ohio, out there in the Midwest, where he had a tough upbringing. He was one of 10 kids in a working-class family that was always struggling for money. He had tenacity and grit, and I could tell he was one of the best people I'd ever know, all grace and humility. I loved him. I still do. Marty Sheen moved in with me in the South Bronx so we could split the rent. We worked together at the Living Theater in Greenwich Village, where we cleaned toilets and laid down rugs for the sets of the plays they put on. The Living Theater had been founded by Judith Molina and Julian Beck, two actors who happened to be true visionaries, who started it in their living room in the 1950s and eventually moved it to 14th Street and 6th Avenue. They did the kinds of shows that made you go home afterward and lock yourself in your room and just cry for 2 days, staring at the ceiling. They had that kind of impact. They created Off-Broadway Theater, and its success paved the way for Off-Off-Broadway. That made it possible for some of the shows I was doing, Off-Off-Off-Off-Broadway, where actors performed in village cafes for audiences drinking coffee and eating pastries. When I did Hello Out There by William Saroyan, we would put on 16 performances a week at Cafe Sino on Cornelia Street and pass the hat to what little audience was there, hoping to come away with a few dollars to have a meal. It was always passing the hat when you performed down there. That's how you ate and afforded your habit. It was our Paris in the early 1900s, our Berlin in the 1920s, a renaissance happening in our great city, New York. That was the spirit of the scene, the energy of Sartre, Ibsen, Bertolt Brecht, Leonard Melfi, Allen Ginsberg, Ferlinghetti, Kerouac, Sam Shepard. We inherited the world they created. When the Living Theater put on a play called The Connection by Jack Gelber, Marty and I would do our work and then stand in the back of the orchestra section of the theater and watch them do that play every night. We were teenagers, still sweaty from having put down the sets that the actors were now performing on. We did it for no pay, just to see where acting could take you, how far you could go with just a plank and a passion. One night, Marty turned to me and said, "See that actor playing that role? That is a great role. I'm going to do it someday." And sure as there is a heaven and earth, old Marty Sheen landed that role for himself. He got it done, and he was great when he did it. One summer, I was sitting on a stoop on 10th Street and 2nd Avenue. The heat had been bearing down on me all day, and I was enjoying the relief that came when the sun finally set and the city cooled down at night. I was wondering how I was going to eat that night. Marty came sauntering up the street like he was walking on air. He had something he wanted to tell me. "Hey, Marty," I yelled out at him. He came back right up to me and said, "Al, I met the girl I'm going to be with for the rest of my life. She's a painter, and she's going to be my wife." I said, "That's a secret well kept, Marty, but we still got to eat." But sure enough, if you look at your calendar and you look at the year, he is still Marty Sheen and Janet is his wife, and she was the girl he told me about 60 years ago. Before I gave up the Bronx apartment for good, other people would come and go. Sometimes one of Marty's brothers would stay over, or this guy Sal Russo from acting class who was going with this girl named Sandra. Their best friend was a musician with long dark hair and piercing eyes named Joan Baez, who would occasionally drop by the apartment, sit cross-legged in a corner, and play her guitar. She hadn't linked up with Bob Dylan yet, but we knew Joan was going places. I don't believe she and I ever exchanged hellos. She was just part of the traffic that came and went in that apartment while the world spun around us. Cliffy was back in the neighborhood again. Both he and Bruce had enlisted in the Army. Bruce made it as far as his induction ceremony when he got second thoughts, pretended to flip out, and threatened to jump out a window, so they let him go. Cliffy, on the other hand, stuck around long enough to serve for a few months, but of course he got in trouble there and was thrown into the brig before being thrown out. I knew I had no risk of being drafted myself because I was supporting my mother. But as Charlie used to say to me every day, "They don't want you in the Army, Al." He knew how crazy I was in terms of my strangeness and my high-pitched anxiety. That was why I drank. Could you imagine me, that boy that I was, going around saying, "Hup, two, three, four." I can do it in a play. Cliffy had come out of the Army in even worse shape. He was on the needle now and doing and saying all kinds of crazy stuff. He said he had been in the same platoon as Elvis Presley, and it turned out he actually was. He said he went to Canada, got a Catholic girl pregnant, and converted from Judaism so that he could marry her. Every time he stopped by my apartment, he would go into the bathroom to shoot up, sometimes alone and sometimes in the company of other people he'd brought with him who just wanted to get their fix, too. With a heavy heart, I had to tell Cliffy he couldn't come around and get off in my bathroom anymore. It was no surprise to anyone when he overdosed and died. It made me think of a story that he had told me. When he was in the brig, Cliffy said, he was watched by this guard, a southerner who carried a .45 pistol. He would hold out the pistol just so to polish it or keep it on his lap. He would start saying ominous things about the Jews, because Cliffy was still Jewish at the time. In his southern drawl, he would tell Cliffy, "You know, I could just blow your head off and tell people you tried to escape. Would that be something to do?" He kept repeating it day after day until Cliffy finally turned to the guy and said, "Hey, man, you know what? You better kill me, because if you don't, when I get out of here, I'm going to come back and kill you." I can only imagine that when this guard looked into his eyes, he saw enough to know that Cliffy meant it. All I can say about that is Cliffy may not have been the toughest guy I ever met, but he certainly was the most fearless. When I turned 21, having hardly started working as an actor, I was asked to do a reading with Elia Kazan, practically the greatest director in the world on both stage and screen, for a new movie he was casting. It was called America, America, and it was going to tell the story of a young Greek man's journey to the United States. They were trying to find a young actor, relatively unknown, probably ethnic-looking, to play the lead role. I thought I had a shot at it. I don't know if I would have excelled at it, but I felt I had a real chance because I fit the description. But I was late and I missed the audition. I went there and they were gone, and it was over. They got somebody else. My first thought at that moment wasn't about me. Before I even got to that audition, I had fantasized how I would help my mother. I would take her out of her destitution and her despondency, give her what she always longed for and needed. Not because it would mean I was successful, not because she could have done things with the money, because she would have engaged herself in it. It would have sparked a natural curiosity, because she was smart. It would have given her a jump start. I think she would have survived. It was Bruce who later told me when my mother was dying. I came back to my apartment in the Bronx late one night from my wanderings in the East Village to find a note he left at my door, saying that he had an urgent message for me. He lived in the tenement next to ours, so I climbed onto the roof and over to his building, went down the stairs, and knocked on his door. Bruce lived with his parents, and he took me into the kitchen of their apartment. He said, "Your mom's in a lot of trouble. She's really sick. You better go, man." I said, "Okay," scraped together whatever money I could, and jumped in a cab to my grandparents' place on 233rd Street. Outside the cab, I looked up and saw the lights on in their apartment. It was a bit bigger than the old place. I went up the stairs, walked in the door, and there were my grandmother and grandfather, their eyes wet with tears. My mother was gone. You see, it was too late. I was too late. She had died like Tennessee Williams had died, choking on her own pills, on her regurgitation of them, like so many have. A lot of people want to leave this world behind for one that's better, and she was in a state where she escaped by taking drugs. It was interpreted by some that she had committed suicide, which she had tried almost 15 years earlier. But she left no note this time, nothing. She was just gone. That's why I always kept a question mark next to her death. When drugs are involved, people often die when they don't intend to kill themselves. I don't know that she did. I'd like to give my mother that benefit of the doubt, that dignity, to be fair to her memory. The next morning, I'll never forget the image of my grandfather sitting in a folding chair in the middle of the room, nothing around him, crouched over with his head in his hands, almost between his legs. He just kept banging a foot on the floor. I'd never seen him that way. I had never seen my grandfather so emotionally stirred. He didn't speak, but I knew what he was saying. No, that was the wrong thing to do. She was too young. She could have been helped. What a waste. Maybe somehow I could have stopped this. My mother's tragedy was poverty. She was stuck in the mud of it and couldn't move. I knew she had the innate intelligence and sensitivity to understand our world because she did have curiosity. She read books, and she had taken piano lessons in her youth when her family could afford them. We went to the movies together, and we always went to the theater when we could. My mother took me to Broadway plays in Manhattan. When I was a teenager, I ended up on the popular TV game show called The Wheel of Fortune. The game show highlighted human interest stories, and I was there because I had helped save my childhood friend Bruce, who ended up dangling from a pipe 20 feet high after a ridiculous bet gone wrong. On the show, I won prizes and some money, and the first thing my mother did with that money was take me to see Cat on a Hot Tin Roof on Broadway. It was just like when I was 3 and 4, only now I was 15, going out to dinner at a restaurant with my own mother after seeing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. She had a gift of a sense of humor and a certain innate taste. That was what made her stand apart from the rest of the family. But she was a lonely woman. Therapy, moderation, security, these things could have helped her. I knew I was going to be able to supply her with that and more. And I don't think I ever told her that. I don't think I ever said to her that I was going to succeed and was going to take care of her. What would I have said to her? Ma, just wait, I'm getting there. It sounds like an Odette's play, but it's true. I knew that in a few more years I was going to be able to help. It's one thing to think this, but how do you tell anyone that you're destined to be successful? Who would believe you? How can you tell someone that you know this is going to happen for you when you're down and out, sleeping in hallways and on floors of theaters, borrowing friends' apartments to get a night's rest? My mother once said to me that she had a dream about me. I was standing on some cliff, like in Wuthering Heights, with the wind blowing my hair, my face pale and undernourished. I was skinny and I looked so drained. I had no color in my face. That dream made her so sad. How do you go from hearing that to saying, "Don't worry, I'm going to make it"? I knew that I was going to get there. That was my blessing. Maybe I learned it when my grandma fed me baby food and made me the star of all the stories she told me. Maybe it was my friends in the street. Maybe it was Marty Sheen or my great friend Charlie Lawton. When did it happen? Who was this kid with this fierce energy that could light a schoolyard at night? Something was driving me. I had to make it because that was the only way I would survive this world. But first came a hard period of mourning, wandering around zombie-like. I was in a state. I started missing my stops at the subway station, bumping into things, thinking about some things, and forgetting other things. It seemed impossible to accept at that age, unfathomable, to lose a mother. I was working as an usher at the Rivoli Theater in Times Square. Some of the other guys who worked there were on the run, and some had families they had to support, and ushering was one of the three jobs they were holding down to feed their wives and children. They'd say to me, "Hey, kid, I got to get some sleep. Could you just cover for me?" I'd say, "Okay," and they'd go take a nap in the balcony. When the Jerseyites would come to the theater, you know the type, usually Saturday nights, the young pretty girls would come up to me and say, "This is for you," and press something into my palm as though it were a tip Then I'd look at whatever was in my hand and see that they had given me a used match from a book of matches. I had to laugh. The theater had a candy counter with a four-way mirror. I would stand in front of it and marvel at the angles of my face, angles I never saw before in my life. Who is this guy I'm looking at in that mirror? I wondered. I saw my profile. I saw myself in three quarters. I saw myself head on, and I thought, how could I be an actor with a face like this? The house manager there, a big old white guy, had his own perspective. He said, I don't like those sideburns. Makes you look like a Mexican. I thought, that's a rather obtuse comment. What does that even mean? Eventually, he fired me for looking myself in the mirror too much. I got fired in flight. It was a beautiful thing, like a ballet. The house manager was all the way up in the balcony, and as he made his way down the theater's colossal winding staircase, this elegant structure like something out of Gone with the Wind, he rounded past me on the second floor, pointed at me, and bellowed, "Now you're fired," and continued on his way to the lobby. He never broke stride. What a graceful way to get the axe. I almost applauded him. At another job, I delivered copies of Show Business newspaper to the newsstands along 7th Avenue. It was published once a week. People in the business would buy it and read it for information about what plays were being performed and where they could audition. This was valuable information. I made $12 for one day of work, and that was a huge payday to me. When I got paid, I'd hit the bar afterwards with my bankroll of singles. I liked to roll my dollar bills into a large ball and peel them off one by one, like a big shot, then snap them down on the counter like I had more where that came from. When you're down and out like that, you try to sleep until 4 p.m. just to stave off hunger. If I could scrape together $1.19 and splurge on a steak and a baked potato at Tad's Steaks, it was like Thanksgiving dinner. I had this little red wagon that I'd used to carry the papers, hitting various newsstands along 7th Avenue, from 34th Street up to 57th Street. In the back of the wagon, I kept a bottle of Chianti wine. When it was pouring rain, they'd give me a head-to-toe poncho that didn't protect me much, but at least it protected the newspapers I was wheeling. I'd pull that wagon up 7th Avenue, already loaded at 9:30 or 10 in the morning, and as I got soaked in the downpour, I made up a little song that I sang to myself as I strode up the street. I feel fine with my bottle of wine. Along with Charlie and Chekhov, I think drinking saved my life. I was able to self-medicate. It helped me through my pain, and it kept me away from the outpatient clinic at Bellevue. I would drink at night and pop pills the next day to calm down. I was always looking to be calm because my mind was going wild and alcohol had a calming effect. If I had cocaine, I would probably levitate, so I used alcohol to ease the pain and emptiness and lower my energy. All I know is it worked for me. I experienced a separation from Charlie. I couldn't tell you why. I don't know what I did or didn't do. It wasn't because we'd had an argument. Suddenly he told me, "You have to move on," which was a strange thing to say, and I felt like a rejection. I think Charlie saw my potential, but he had a life of his own to deal with. He was in his mid-30s with a wife and a child, and he was headed towards something else. I was this kid in my early 20s, vulnerable and not fully developed. I was borderline hopeless. Maybe I called him too much. Maybe I was too dependent on him. Maybe he thought that after losing my mother, I needed something else. But my level of sophistication wasn't up to his. I was behind, and he was ahead. Our falling out didn't last very long. There was no reconciliation. Just somehow by osmosis, we got back together. But I was sensitive to how he had distanced himself from me. It hit me hard. I was feeling adrift and alone in the village, caught up in my feelings about my mother and in a general malaise. Everything about my life was fading out. I got on a payphone in a bar and called my granddad up in the Bronx to tell him what I was going through, and I started to cry. He just kept saying, "Come on, come with us, live with me, come live with us. I was really bawling. He said, come here, come with me. I was stunned, but I didn't go. I stayed where I was. I had moved out of the Bronx by that time and found a low-rent rooming house in Chelsea for $8 a week. Another time I called my grandfather after he had arranged to get me a job in construction. I had been up all night the night before I was supposed to start, and I rang him up at 7 o'clock in the morning. And he picked up the phone and said, you're not going to work. I know. That's okay. You know how difficult it is to get a job at a construction site? I'm sure he worked hard to do that for me. But I kept doing these other menial jobs. That's all I could do. I had no education and no desire to have more. I was interested in one thing. I believed I was an artist. My grandfather passed away himself that year, which does happen when that kind of trauma hits, when a parent loses a child. My mother was his first child, and they had a great relationship. He loved her, and she loved her dad. It was obvious. I was still doing the show business newspaper deliveries at that time, and I passed out on the route. It must have been from lack of food and the trauma of losing my granddad. He was a warm man with a soft heart, though he came from a merciless world. When his family moved to East Harlem, where many Sicilians had settled, they lived among the gangsters who had yet to become household names but were still notorious at that time. That world was there for my grandfather and easy to access, but though he was poor, he didn't want to go in that direction. As he once said to me, he never had the heart to go into that underworld. My grandfather had trouble with his stepmother, so when he was 9, he quit school and ran away to work on a coal truck and didn't come back until he was 15. He was a wild kid who traveled with his fellow urchins around Upper Manhattan and the Bronx back when it was all farmland. When he could, he'd do apprentice jobs or get work in the fields out there and live under the stars. This was the early 1900s when everyone mostly traveled by foot or by horse-drawn carriage, and he was living in the heart of this harbor town. It was a tough road he had chosen for himself, but it seemed like an adventure to him. His town in Sicily had a tradition of skilled masons, and he became a plasterer, just as his father had been, becoming more and more skilled in his craft as he grew older. His expertise was what kept our family alive. People used to marvel at his work. His son, my uncle, used to say that if he had my grandfather's talent, he would own New York. My grandfather would tell the story of when he was working in a fancy office building in mid-Manhattan. Katharine Hepburn happened to be there and looked up at his ladder, watched him work, and smiled up at him. I said to him, what was she like? And he said, oh, she was nice. She had a lot of freckles. When I was a youngster, I watched him work on the building where we lived, and I noticed the focus he had. He was in a zone. There was no other world but that. Nothing else existed. The movements of his hands were so decisive, so clear and clean, and fast and intricate. His focus alone would draw you in. It had a gravitas, like a painter absorbed in his canvas. I'm sure it affected me, because that's the way I would one day look at my own work. I don't talk about him much, but I was influenced by him, his humor, his intelligence. Charlie met him once and saw in an instant how he just lit up and how his kindness could reach people. He saw a man with a soul. I loved him greatly. I'm still here because of him, and I'll never forget it. I was finally starting to make some acquaintances downtown in the village, fellow artists or actors. One friend, Tommy Negron, who I grew up with in the South Bronx, was a piano tuner who I thought was going to be a great musician. He would let me sleep on the floor of his place, where he had a big jar of pennies that I would take a dip into from time to time. A handful of pennies could get you far back then. Alec Rubin was a longtime member of the Actors Studio, a part of their director's unit and an occasional moderator there. I liked him, and he used to put me in plays in a little performance space below his apartment on West 72nd Street. I once took a bath in his bathtub, then went downstairs to join in his production of Why is a Crooked Letter, which I was starring in. The space was so small that, as I was smoking in character, a woman from the audience reached in and gave me an ashtray. I did children's shows at Theater East, comic send-ups of fairy tales. In one, I was a blowhard hunter coming to rescue Little Red Riding Hood's grandmother from the big bad wolf. In another, I was a frog who turned into a prince, but wanted to go back to being a frog because his girlfriend was still a frog. It was a musical, and I sang songs in it. I would come in for afternoon shows on Saturdays and Sundays, still half-stoned from the night before, and sing and dance in these plays, and somehow got through them. They paid me real money to eat and to get through the rest of the weekend. The Actors Gallery was a playhouse in Soho, just a little room up a flight of stairs that sat maybe 25 or 30 people. It was run by Frank Biancamano, who had also been my dispatcher when I was a 16-year-old bike messenger. When I walked into my audition for him, he asked, "Don't I know you?" I was a little embarrassed to see him, now standing there as an actor when he knew me as a teenager. I stood there, stooping awkwardly low and showing him various sides of my face, pretending to be sensitive, because I didn't want him to recognize me. But he liked my audition, saw something in me, and took me on. He started to put me in plays like Jean Girardot's Tiger at the Gates and Thomas Mann's Mario and the Magician. Heady stuff. And then he cast me for a part in Creditors, a three-character play by August Strindberg. It was a strange piece about a woman and two men, one her ex-husband and the other newly married to her, that I wasn't sure I totally grasped. But now I was working with other experienced actors. They were giving great performances, and I was part of it. And then one night, on stage, just like that, it happened. The power of expression was revealed to me in a way it never had before. I wasn't even searching for it. That's the beauty of these things. You're not looking for it. I'm opening my mouth, and I'm understanding somehow that I can speak. Words are coming out, and they're the words of Strindberg, but I'm saying them as though they're mine. The world is mine, and my feelings are mine, and they're going beyond the South Bronx. I felt the familiar. I became a part of something larger. I thought that there was more to me, a feeling that I belonged to a whole world and not just to one place. I'm thinking to myself, what is this? It feels as though I'm lifting off the ground. I thought, yes, this is it. I'm right here, and I can reach out and touch it. This is out there, and this is what I know now is possible. All of a sudden, in that moment, I was universal. I knew I didn't have a worry after that. I eat, I don't eat. I make money, I don't make money. I'm famous, I'm not famous. It didn't mean anything anymore. And that's lucky in this business when you don't care about that. A door was opening, not to a career, not to success or fortune, but to the living spirit of energy. I had been given this insight into myself, and there was nothing else I could do but say, I want to do this forever. Chapter 3, A Tiger and an Indian. Herbert Berghoff was not quick to anger, and he was furious with me. All it took was seeing me act. It was a practice at HB Studio that every so often all the acting classes would gather in a seminar room, and each teacher would pick one or two of their students to perform a scene with Berghoff watching at the front. It was something of a distinction to be selected, and the level of work that was put on was usually pretty high. Charlie had picked me and a classmate to do a short selection from a teleplay called Crime in the Streets about a gang of street kids. I had worked on the scene before in other acting classes, and with Charlie, so I felt I had a good handle on it. I put on a white tank top, which I thought suited the character, and I gave the scene the energy that I thought it required. When the performance was over, I went back to my seat next to Charlie in the half-dark room. Charlie grabbed my arm and squeezed it and whispered, "You were great, Al. You were great." I was happy to hear it, but there was something in Charlie's bearing. He was trying to communicate, and he had to whisper because we were surrounded by others in the class. I immediately sensed that something was up. From his own seat, Berghoff began to discuss the scene. Berghoff was a stern Austrian who had fled Vienna before the war. I watched his face turn red as he absolutely exploded at me. "Who do you think you are?" he said. "Who gave you the right to do things like that?" He spoke with ferocity and bitterness. All the while, Charlie was still squeezing my arm and whispering, "You were great." As an actor, your performance is always a reflection of how you feel about things. Not just what's on the page, but whatever you're feeling in the moment, your issues, as we might call them today. And you don't always know what you feel until you're in the scene and delivering the lines. But what you're doing is always an expression of yourself. I was simply doing a scene that I thought expressed something in me, embodying a kind of person I had once known and a world I spent time in. I couldn't figure what I might have done to make Berghoff so emotional. He was a reputable actor and a major force in the theater. He had directed the original Broadway production of Waiting for Godot, and his opinion meant something. Perhaps he instinctively didn't like me or my type. I looked like I had come in off the streets. I had encountered that kind of bias in my life before. Did he think I was overdoing it? Was I exposing too much of my physique? Should I have worn some sort of cloak? The uncharacteristic severity of his response stayed with me for a long time. I'm talking decades. When I was in my 70s and Charlie was deeply ill with multiple sclerosis, I would visit him at his hospital in Santa Monica and sit by his bedside and talk to him. One day, I happened to bring up what had gone down in the classroom all those years ago. I said to him, "Hey, Charles, remember when I did that scene that one time and Berghoff went crazy?" Charlie said, "Yeah, I remember that day. I thought about it, too." "What do you think happened there?" I asked him. "What was that about, really?" And Charlie said, "I think he saw the future." It was the early 1960s, and something was happening in acting. I wondered if it was alien to someone like Herbert Berghoff. Perhaps he didn't like my choice of material, didn't relate to it personally, or didn't like the way it was expressed. Not just my scene, but other selections he had watched other students perform that day were similarly outside the realm of his understanding. Or maybe it wasn't such a shock to him at all. Maybe people like him had seen this train coming in the distance for some time, and now it had arrived at his doorstep. It could have felt like a new chapter was about to be written, and it wasn't going to include him. It had started with Brando. He was the influence, the force, the originator. What he had created, together with collaborators like Tennessee Williams and Ilya Kazan, was more visceral. It was threatening. Brando had become part of a triumvirate of actors, along with Montgomery Clift and James Dean. Clift had the beauty and the soul, the vulnerability. Dean was like a sonnet, compact and economical, able to do so much with the merest gesture or nuance. And if Dean was a sonnet, then Brando was an epic poem. He had the looks, he had the charisma, he had the talent. There's that classic sequence from A Streetcar Named Desire, where Brando completely loses it during the card game until he's at the bottom of the stairs yelling, "Stella! Stella!" It's an episode that builds gradually, which of course comes from Kazan's original staging of the play and Brando's memory of it as he had done it every night. But by the time Brando got this on film, he had become one with the elements. You experienced that sequence like you experienced a tornado or a monsoon. It was that captivating. But evolution always makes people nervous. There was anger toward Brando. People said he mumbled. They said his features were too soft, too delicate. They said he liked to show off his chest. If people disparaged his approach, it was because they didn't see the technique that went into it. but he found whatever it was that opened the door to his expression, that allowed him to reveal himself and communicate it to audiences so that they identified with him. Brando made possible the Paul Newmans of the world, the Ben Gazzaras, the Anthony Franciosas, and the Peter Falks, people like John Cassavetes, who was his own special kind of phenomenon. These were the idols of an era just before mine, actors who had already moved beyond the studios and had been out in the world for a decade or more by the time I arrived there. And then Dustin Hoffman just blasted open the door for actors. Dustin was a student of Lee Strasberg's at the Actors Studio when I started to hear about him. You would pick up on other students discussing him with a strange reverence, like he was a ghost or a wanted criminal. There was such energy around his name, you had to see him for yourself to see if he lived up to his formidable reputation. And then Mike Nichols got hold of him, all of him, for The Graduate. The Graduate was contemporary and of the moment, a commentary on the world we were living in, and it fit him perfectly. It came along at the right time, right when we were ready for it, and its success made Dustin a movie star supreme. I was working up in Boston when The Graduate opened, and I said, "This is it, man. It's over. He's broken the sound barrier." The excitement for me was in seeing an artist doing something so well, something original, that you recognized had never been done before. In the early 1960s, we all knew Marty Sheen was on his way. He was still working off-Broadway work when he saw me on the subway one day. I was standing on the platform waiting for a train with a long coat that went down to my ankles. I'd looked like I was playing a part in a Charlie Chaplin film from the silent era. It had been about a year since we had roomed together, and our careers had gone in different directions. He was working regularly, and I was still down and out. My next move was to hold my hand out for somebody to put a coin in it. He said, "Hey, Al, man, how are you doing?" I said, "I'm okay." And he looked at me in my dusty thrift store coat and my shoes that were ripped apart and my toes poking through the holes, and he knew that maybe that was not the case. But he looked past all of this and said to me, "Al, would you do me the honor," he actually said that honor, "of understudying me in this part that I'm doing?" He was starring in The Wicked Cooks by Gunter Grass, a real far-out and allegorical play that was very physical for him. He was constantly getting hit with props and thrown to the ground in it. Now, we both knew I couldn't be an understudy, not to Marty, not to anybody, not for any moral reasons. I was just incapable of it. I wish I was able to, because it was a way to make some money. But for whatever reason, I'm easily distracted watching someone else do a performance that I would have to mimic. But this play was at the Orpheum on 2nd Avenue, which was practically like being on Broadway. And it was money in my pocket. So I thanked him and said, "Of course, Marty, I'll do it." I thought I was doing it for Marty because he seemed so effusive about me. He loved me, and I was just so enamored of him. Of course, the director hated my guts. He just seemed to have it in for me from the start. I had that anarchic look. No matter where I went, people looked at me as if to say, "Where does this guy come from? Who does he think he is?" Something was there in my bearing, whatever it was, that bothered people in certain situations, usually in the theater. When I encountered authority figures, there could be a little tension. The director was a guy named Vesek Simic, and he ran the play like he was a dictator. I saw an invisible whip in his hand. He would yell at me, "Method actor!" It was a taunt, a put-down. When I found out I had to be in the play as an extra, a soldier just walking around the stage when I wasn't playing Marty's part, I don't even know what I'm doing out on the street. What am I going to do on the stage? I would pretend that I was walking around, but I would leave the theater altogether. And Simic was getting madder and madder at me. I'm looking at this guy thinking, there's no way this is going to work. You know what had to happen next. There was only one way for this to turn out. First, Marty Sheen had to get laryngitis. He came in one day coughing and croaking. I was probably hiding out in some corner of the theater, sitting alone and reading Spinoza, when he grabbed me and looked me straight in the eye. He said in his raspy voice, "Al, buddy, my friend, you have to go on for me. I've lost my voice, but you can do it." I said, "What?" I couldn't hear him. That's how bad his laryngitis was. He said, "You're going on." I was transfixed. I thought perhaps it was a practical joke and that in a moment he would regain his voice and laugh at me. He wasn't laughing or joking. I didn't want to let down my friend, but I knew nothing about what he did or said in the play. It was like getting caught in the vault of a bank and trying to explain that you didn't go there to rob it. I said, "Marty, I can't. I don't know the words." He said, "You'll make it up." I said, "I can't do this, Marty." So I didn't, and Simic fired me. I only found out later that the production wasn't even paying me to be Martin's understudy in the play. Marty was paying me himself out of his own salary. He just wanted me to have the money. I wanted to give it back to him, but he wouldn't take it. I was sitting in a Jewish cafeteria in the East Village, lamenting how I'd let Marty down, and this other actor who was very good in the play was there. He came over to me and seemed to think I was in need of advice. He spoke with a bit of a lisp, which was unusual for an actor, and he said, "Let me tell you, if I was you, I'd be back there learning those words." I was someone that the wolves threw out of their den. I had been exiled by a dictator director, so I was just grateful he didn't shoot me. This guy was giving me a pep talk about what to do. I thought, "You know what I'm doing. I'm going home and I'm never coming back." That was the end of that one. The book has two sections of photographs, and I just have a couple minutes left, and I want to read some descriptions of several of the photographs from Pacino's younger years. The first one is, the caption reads, "In a dark black and white photo, a man and a woman stand on either side of a tall stool in front of a curtain backdrop. On the top of the stool, a baby sits upright on a tall cushion, supported on both sides by the hands of his parent. The man wears a double-breasted suit over a white dress shirt and tie. His hair is combed neatly back, and he smiles at the camera. The woman wears a white blouse with a dark jacket and matching skirt that reaches below her knees, and black sandals with a low heel. Her curled hair is adorned with a white bow, and she also smiles at the camera. The baby is wearing a white, fuzzy, hooded outfit. His little arms are lifted slightly at his sides, his little feet sticking out in front of him. He has round cheeks, and his mouth is open in an O, and his eyes are very wide." And the caption in the book is, "Me with my father and mother. It looks like I've been kidnapped." The second photo is a black and white close-up, and a naked baby lies on his belly on a fur rug in front of a wicker background. His head on the left is raised as he looks around, and his legs on the right are slightly bent with his feet lifted in together. His left arm is straight, propping himself up, his hand gripping the rug in a tiny fist. He has a light scattering of hair, slightly longer and curled on the top. His dark eyes appear focused on an object or person outside the picture. His eyebrows are drawn up slightly and together. His mouth is partly open in a slight, toothless smile. And the caption for that picture reads, "I know that fur had to have been very comfortable." The caption on the next photo reads, "My mother and father in the center. I don't know the two other people." And a description is, "A black and white photo shows two men, two women standing in front of a painted backdrop that depicts a blank wall and stairs. The men wear small white boutonniere flowers, and the women wear larger white flower corsages pinned to their chests. They all stand shoulder to shoulder, facing forward with their arms hanging naturally at their sides. The first man on the left wears a neatly pressed gray striped suit and tie. He has dark wavy hair and does not smile. Pacino's father stands next to him, wearing a dark double-breasted suit and tie. His dark hair is neatly combed and parted, and he smiles broadly, showing teeth. Pacino's mother stands next to him wearing a knee-length dark dress with a square collar and short sleeves with lace trim. She wears dark open-toed shoes with heels and a strap at the ankle and a black choker-style necklace. Her dark hair curls about her face to her shoulders, and she also smiles, showing teeth. Next to her is a woman wearing a white blouse and patterned knee-length skirt with a high belted waist. She too wears dark open-toed heels with a strap. Her hair is pulled back from her forehead, and the rest of it curls to her shoulders. She wears dark lipstick but is not smiling. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. This has been Margaret with Biographies and Memoirs. I've been reading from the book Sonny Boy by Al Pacino, copyright 2024. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.